Well, welcome to the Talky Bit. We are continuing our exploration of the distinction between values and identity. And the published subject for our Talky Bit today is of values and identity, part three. Now, if you are a detail-oriented person, and some in this community are, you could be excused for wondering where parts one and two went. So let me clear that up. And while we're at it, I'll just expand some of those ideas a little bit. So we've been enjoying so many other great adventures over the last few weeks. We had our tabletop games morning, which, if you missed that, you might not think you're a games player. I think you would have experienced that as just a delightful opportunity to engage in something new and intriguing, and at whatever entry point you feel comfortable with other people that were in the room, it was very delightful in its spirit and also richly resourced by way of options by Jason and Sarah. So thanks for that. So we did that, and then this morning that I've already mentioned, where Misty was exploring some of the yogic teachings that she's been steeping in as somebody who's growing in her own education and skill as a yoga instructor, trauma-informed yoga teacher. And so all of that together means that part one of this happened like way back in mid-April. And just to confuse matters, it was called If You're Looking for a Sign. So that's very clever of me, I know, to disguise part one of something by calling it something completely different and apparently unrelated. And you can, of course, think about that as part one or not. That doesn't really matter, except to the degree that some of the ideas we were checking out in the talkie bit called If You're Looking for a Sign are related to things that we've talked about in the following weeks. So then part two was on April 23rd, and that was more helpfully and maybe unconsciously, ironically called Of Values, Identity, and Errors. I am a learning, growing human being. So since then, there's been all this other good stuff spread out, mixed in with all these other good things. And so because of that, I'm going to offer us a little bit of a recap today, and then, as I said, we'll just expand some of those. So way back in April, we touched on the thought that the thing that makes us unique as humans, that sort of sets us apart in the natural world, is not making tools or having language. We're increasingly aware that there are animals that do both of those, but rather it's our capacity to imagine a higher power, not simply existing, but at work in the world. All right, so a bit of a unique structure to that. This is something that I would say most of us do one way or another. The alternative to that, by the way, is to believe that there is only the material, that there's only matter. And that is basically a functional definition of atheism. To be an atheist is to be a materialist. And the data on this continent says that about 3% of Americans, about 8% of people on this side of the border identify as atheists, which is why I would feel confident saying that most of us have some kind of conscious engagement with the notion of a higher power or a spiritual realm. And if that idea immediately rubs you the wrong way, even a little, it might be because some part of your imagination, I'm speculating here obviously, but it might be because some part of your imagination went straight to assuming when I said that I was talking about religion, when I said that most of us have some way of thinking about a higher power existing and at work in the world. And if you're like, eh, that might have been because you thought I was talking about religion, or imagined that what I meant was that the way we imagine a higher power existing and at work in the world is by making a religion. And for many of us as humans, that is in fact the case. That's how we do that. And we've considered this in this series. We've talked about how religion offers us a ready-made set of language and symbols by which to speak of, to have a sense of access to that imagined higher power, and to be able to visualize how that power might be at work in the world. And in the Christian tradition, for example, we find a collection of names for that power. The broadest, most sort of embracing one of which would simply be God, and then the enfleshed or incarnated, the made human one, if you will, of that is Jesus. And the spooky one is the Holy Spirit, you know, like the really mysterious one, right? So those are examples from that tradition. If we considered the Hebrew tradition on which the Christian tradition is built, we find a whole collection of names, many of which point to attempts to understand particular aspects of our lived human experience as those experiences relate to how we imagine the divine. So these names for the divine are ways of, they have meanings, just like the Christian ones that I just mentioned. And those meanings sort of point to us kind of going, I wonder if this is how this mystery intersects with our lived experience. Now, if you grew up around some of the more charismatic Christian traditions, especially, you might have encountered a real fondness for accessing these names as a way of you know, explaining, in air quotes, certain attributes of the divine and how those operate. Now, that list, if we're going into the Hebrew tradition, that list of names for God is a long one. There's lots of them. And I'm not going to nerd out on this because you can easily look it up. And also, it's such a deep well that if we fall into it, we might not come out. But by way of helping us all know what I'm talking about, some of the more common examples would be names like Adonai or Elohim or El, which is just sort of the Hebrew God, or Shaddai. And you can assemble them into pairs. So you might have heard the pair of El Shaddai, for example. There's one aspect of this that does intrigue me enough to take a moment with it. So I'm not going to dive right in there. But there's one way of looking at this collection of names that I think can be helpful in the conversation we're having this morning. So by way of an example, Adonai is a name for God from that tradition, and it has a complex history. And lots of these names do have a complex and varied history, and that's important because at every point in that history, they have carried meaning in context, right? So this one, Adonai, was used by the Phoenicians as a name for their god, Tammuz. And it's also the origin of the Greek name Adonis, which we may have heard in sort of vernacular as referring to somebody who's, you know, especially godlike as a human. Linguistically, Adonai is similar to Adon, which is similar to Aten, which is the first recorded monotheistic god of Akhenaten in Egypt, and probably related to that god. And of course, that concept of God being one, not many, is a concept that demonstrably the Hebrews borrowed from the Egyptians. And so here's a way in which that one particular way of referencing this idea of the divine present and at work in the world is kind of carried by that name through several different traditions and understandings, right? Now, the Hebrews tended to use this name in the singular because they were committed at that point in history to this idea of monotheism, this notion that the divine was one. However, the fact that they chose to use that name in the singular doesn't actually limit it. It just means that's the way that they used it. It can also be written in the plural, and sometimes in the Hebrew tradition it was. And there are other Hebrew names for God that can also be written in plural form. And when they are, what that means, so again, language carries meaning, right? What that points to is that this idea of God, this particular notion of the divine, a present and at work in the world, embodies or embraces or sort of surrounds and takes into itself all of the many gods that were worshipped by the ancestors of the Israelites and also were worshipped concurrently by the surrounding people. So they used that name, for example, as in the singular, as a way of saying our idea about the divine actually takes into itself and encompasses all these other ideas about the divine. That's a different way of thinking about monotheism, isn't it, than just our God wins, which is often the way it tends to come out in the language. So I think that's kind of interesting. When it comes to reflecting on how we use religious language and symbols to give us tools to talk about mystery, this idea that we might use that language or those symbols in a way that that touches on or draws in or embraces other language for the divine and other symbols, that's fascinating. I find it fascinating from the perspective of generosity, of making welcome other ideas, but I also find it fascinating from the perspective of thinking differently about the history of our own notions about the divine, that they could well be thought of as a collection of ideas. Sort of like walking through this might not be the most charitable illustration, sort of like walking through tall grass or walking through the forest, you know, with cotton pants on and coming out with all kinds of things stuck to them. Kind of like that, right? As a collection of things that are picked up as the culture, as the people making this cultural thing that talks about the divine have traveled. These things are stuck on and become part of it. And it could sound a little bit like the way we use the term universe these days in spiritual conversations. It's almost kind of like a catch-all for what is beyond us, or a way of gathering together ideas and giving them a word. sometimes it really does feel to me, when I reflect on these things, like everything old is new again, as my grandmother liked to say. But, and this is an important but, I would say, religion isn't the only thing that gives us language for mystery. Science does that as well. And increasingly, the language that science offers us is deep in the zone of the mysterious, pointing to realms where things behave in ways that we can't make sense of, such as when, you know, a particular particle is in two different places at the same time or moving in two different directions at the same time. One particle, two direct. Anyway, does that sound like the kind of thing that we might use spirit language for in another context, in the context of religion, if we were trying to describe something that's such a head scratcher? We might default to the language of the ephemeral, of spirit, right? And in this realm of science, we are more and more often encountering a fascinating intersection, which is the intersection between contemporary Western-rooted or European-rooted science and ancient wisdom, including overtly spiritual wisdom. There's a very lively conversation at that intersection. If you want to explore this through a relatively accessible gateway, you could try reading some of the folks that are bringing together Western science and indigenous teachings. There's a lot going on in that realm right now. I want to just offer us one example of this that I found fascinating this past week. There's lots. So this is from a journal article published by MIT, March 2018, so a while ago already. It was titled, If Indigenous Peoples Stand With Sciences, Will Scientists Stand With Us? And I want to read you a little bit of a longer quote here from the abstract for that article, because it gives us a good, fairly concise window in to this. Indigenous sciences build knowledge about the world, and really when we're talking about the ways in which we consider all of these mysteries, that's really what we're trying to do, right? Is we're trying to know and understand what's going on around us. Indigenous sciences build knowledge about the world through a distinct set of orienting values, concepts, and questions. These include, listen to this list. This is fascinating. What is worthy of attention? What needs explanation? Who is related? And how? Why does it matter, that relationship? Tiwa scholar. Tiwa is indigenous people of from the region that we would think of as southern United States, Arizona, Pueblo people. Anyway, distinct indigenous cultural group from that area. And there's a scholar from that people group, name of Gregory Khajiit. And he has articulated one of the most important concepts of indigenous science this way, and this is actually a fairly well-known summary in this field of study. He would say this: everything is related, that is, connected in dynamic, interactive, and mutually reciprocal relationships. And that foundation, that what he calls a foundational premise, shapes indigenous sciences both in principle and in practice through methods of knowledge building. And Khajiit goes on to say this: the ultimate aim of native science, again, his language, not mine, is not explaining an objectified universe. You may recognize in that phrase many of the ways that we were taught science, sort of Western science. It's like we take the universe apart. There was a long time there was a mechanistic model for the universe. It's like a big complex machine, and if we can figure out what the parts are, you know, we can explain it. So he says as distinct from that, the ultimate aim of native science is not explaining an objectified universe, but rather learning about and understanding responsibilities and relationships and celebrating those that humans establish with the world. So instead of taking it apart, picking apart the pieces, scrutinizing them as though we weren't part of it, we're embedded in this project. He goes on to say this: native science is also about mutual reciprocity, which simply means a give and take relationship with the natural world, and which presupposes a responsibility to care for, sustain, and respect the rights of other living things, plants, animals, and the place in which one lives. It's a really different perspective. And then the article goes on to offer some of what the authors call empirical examples of instances where the indigenous perspective in the practice of contemporary science has led scientists to ask different questions and to see the systems that they're scrutinizing in a different light. And that has radically altered, in some cases, up completely reversed the conclusions that they have reached. By studying the same in this case some animal sciences examples, the same animal behaviors. Like they're looking at the same data, if you will, but through a very different lens and reaching completely different conclusions about what the data means. Really fascinating. Now, again, we could fall in here and not come out ever, but for our purposes, I want to return to this line. Indigenous sciences build knowledge about the world through a distinct set of orienting values, concepts, and questions. These questions include what is worthy of attention, what needs explanation, who is related, how, and why does it matter? Now, I grew up being taught a set of meaning-making questions that was similar. What's the nature of the world around us? What's wrong with the world around us? What might be done about what's wrong? And those kinds of questions. They were similar in the sense that they were after the same thing, but they were also different in some very significant ways, sort of in a way that's akin, in my imagination, to that intersection between Western science and Indigenous science. So, for instance, the questions that I was taught did not include the presupposition that everything is related. But instead of that, they made the assumption that all things material were in a subservient relationship to humanity. They were placed under our feet, as it were, by God, that we're the rulers of this stuff. It's ours to use as we and dispose of as we see fit. Those two ideas reflect very different values, and they're going to lead whoever's making meaning of their experiences to head in quite different directions in the process. We're going to end up with a different conclusion from the same experiences if we ask those two different sets of questions of them. Wildly different, perhaps. And maybe we can see in an example like this one that while religion as a language comes ready-made with all the components that are needed to express emotions or desires, the stuff of spiritual experiences, so do other human constructs such as science or cultural traditions in general. Those things also come with those kinds of tools, but from different perspectives. So this is where we get to the difference between values and identity, which is what I said we were going to explore. What all those different ways of accessing the spiritual have in common is that they carry all those different sets of language, all those different sets of symbols. What they have in common is that they carry values. And those values can be understood as separate from the identity of those that hold them. For example, we might find ourselves drawn to the values of Western science, and many of us are unconsciously aligned with these values because we're surrounded by them and we've been taught them our whole lives. But to make them explicit, these are values such as, and this is not an exhaustive list, but it's reasonable, I think. So Western scientific values include things like empirical adequacy, simplicity, complexity. So we're measuring both those things, scope, accuracy, fruitfulness, certainty, internal coherence, external consistency with accepted theories, replicability, precision, utility, quantification, and objectivity. You might recognize, if you stand back from that set of values, that those are the kinds of things that were being used to background and justify, to fortify the directions that we were given during the pandemic. And they were summed up by saying, the science says, or we've got new data that says, and on the basis of that. And so all of this input that was coming into the decision-making bodies, the people who were going to offer social direction and say, here's the right thing or best thing to do under these circumstances, they were measuring the information they had against that sort of set of values, summed up as the science says, right? So many of us responded positively to that. We trusted that perspective. I'm not suggesting anything about the rightness or wrongness of that. Rather, just want to point to the fact that when we're informed by these kinds of values, that's how we tend to proceed with enacting those values. So let's take those values. Now, by way of separating those from identity, let me say this. We might measure what we choose to believe by holding it up to those sorts of values. The example I just gave about being given social direction in the pandemic based on science. So we might choose to do that. We might choose to measure what we believe by holding it up to those kinds of values to consider its merit. And then we might proceed according to that assessment. So that's working with the values. But in terms of identity, we might do all of that and not identify as scientists, right? Yes, this set of values permeates the way that I think, perhaps, and I might use it to measure things, but I'm not a scientist. That's an identity. And it's unique and particular. And it's not me. When we were together last week and the parent panel was sharing, Teresa talked about having Christian values and an indigenous identity, right? So that's another way of expressing this same distinction between values and identity. By the way, if you're catching this as a podcast listener, and you don't know what I'm talking about in terms of the parent panel and Teresa and so on, you can go to our podcast archive at thetablewinnipeg.com and you'll find a parent panel episode there, and you can listen to folks talk about this. But that's the difference, right, between values and identity. So I think it might be helpful at this point to dig just a little deeper into that difference between values and identity, and that's kind of going to set our trajectory for the next little piece of our reflection here. And I'm going to start into that today by offering a few more ideas about what we might mean by a word like values. And then the next time we're on this topic, we'll expand on that, and then we'll explore some more ideas. In due course, we'll explore some more ideas about the identity part of that. I know I've said this before, but I believe that this topic is worth exploring in our context, not least of all because so many people in the surrounding culture and in this community would say or resonate with the saying, I'm spiritual but not religious, or I have Christian values but I don't identify with that religion. I have some of those values but I wouldn't call myself a Christian, or would just generally name their values without associating them with any wider group or religious identity. I can't even count the number of times that I've personally had a conversation that included something along the lines of, I don't think I'm a Christian anymore. I'm not even going to dip into the conversation about what it means in different sort of Christian systems of belief to become not Christian. you could write a graduate or a doctoral thesis on that one if you cared to, and you wouldn't be short on material. There's a lot of different perspectives on that. What matters to me is that people are having this experience of ceasing to identify with a particular religion, but are finding it difficult to know how to think or speak about that because they were taught, among other things, that the religion that they were handed or that they may have previously identified with was sort of ground zero for what is spiritual, for what is the way that we might imagine this divine presence alive and at work in the world. And in many cases, they were also taught that leaving that religion was turning away from the divine, which can add some distress to the experience. It was turning your back on God, right? I think that getting a bit more clarity about the difference between values and identity might be able to help us navigate this terrain with more equanimity, more kindness to ourselves and to others in the process, and can help us know how to stay connected to community in the process. Can help what is a challenging thing do more good and less harm. So for now, at least, a little bit more about what we might mean when we talk about values. So let's start with a definition. Here's a definition for the word values. Values are basic and fundamental beliefs that guide or motivate attitudes or actions. Values are basic and fundamental beliefs that guide or motivate attitudes or actions. So we can see right away in that definition that there's a built-in link between values and beliefs. Values are basic and fundamental beliefs, is the first part of the definition, right? Now, the simplest way that I know of to define belief is an attachment to an idea or concept. One of my adult kids shared this idea with me recently, and it just stuck. It just felt to me like it pulled it together in some really wonderful ways. And then they followed that up by saying, that seems like a really stupid thing to kill somebody over, doesn't it? Your attachment to an idea or a concept. And yet this is what we do. We can readily tell by personal experience and by looking around us that we can believe in pretty much anything. Doesn't have to be demonstrably factual. It might even be demonstrably nonsensical. The power isn't in the idea or concept itself. It's in the belief in that idea. It's in our attachment to that idea. We don't die for something because it's true. We don't die for something because it should be true for everyone. We die because we believe in it. The power is in the belief. And that fact, that the power is in the belief, that is what makes changing our beliefs so disconcerting. It really shakes us up when we encounter something that gets in the face of a belief that we've held and makes us wonder if it's true. You may have had that experience with a belief. And you know what that feels like inside, where you're like, uh-oh, what if this isn't true? Then what's true? What do I believe? John Stuart Mill, arguably the most influential English language philosopher of the 19th century, put it this way. He said, "One person with a belief is equal to a force of 99 who have only interests." So, changing a belief can be seismic. It can really shake things up. Back to values. Values can help us determine what's important to us. They can describe the personal qualities that we choose to embody. They can describe the things that we choose to enact, the things that guide our actions. Words are pretty easy, even when they're hard, compared to actions, right? Choosing how we're going to act, it's where the rubber really meets the road. Values are what guide us in becoming the sort of person that we want to be. The ways that we treat ourselves, the ways that we treat others, the ways that we interact with the world around us. And beyond that, in wider society, values can provide general guidelines for how we conduct ourselves. What we agree is okay and what we agree isn't. And so in a relatively narrow sense, values point us toward what is good, what is desirable, what is worthwhile. And that is essentially the space that we ended up in during our parent panel last week. We ended up articulating a shared value of kindness. Everyone agreed that kindness was good, desirable, worthwhile value to both enact and to teach our kids. It mattered. In a wider sense, we could think of values as the motive or the energy behind purposeful action. I hope that makes sense, right? Values are the stuff, they're the fuel that enacting something is running on. I'm intrigued, but when I think about my own history, I don't think I'm surprised, especially as a person, but I'm intrigued by how many people I talk to who have never stopped to deliberately ask, what do I value? Or to put it another way, do I know what does or what would motivate me to act in a purposeful manner? Purpose is powerful. Purposeful action is powerful. Values are the ends to which we act, the thing that we are working to bring into being in the world, the thing that keeps us from just drifting along on the tide of whatever's going on around us. I was having a conversation with somebody this past week about a friend of theirs who, whenever they get into something, they just get right into it and they just start firing out ideas. Oh, I'm going to get really into this and I'm going to learn this and then I'm going to study that and then I'm going to start a business, blah, 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 blah. And they just kind of go off about whatever their new interest is. And this person making this observation about their friend was like, you know what, with that person, I just wait and see. Because it's easy to say all that stuff. It's easy to get excited about all that stuff. But what we do, what we actually put our time and energy and effort into, that's what reveals what the energy source is. That reveals what the purpose is. That's what reveals what our values actually are. When our values are unexamined, we may not know why we're doing what we're doing. And we won't have a sense to a connection, to a sense of purpose. And when we don't have a connection to a sense of purpose, that can be really hard on us as human beings. That can be a space that in which we're quite vulnerable to a number of difficult lived experiences, including maybe obviously something like depression, right? When I think about, for example, my years here at the table, and I think about the different challenges that we've faced, that we continue to face, and I ask myself, what is it that has kept me personally working to make a contribution to having this particular community in this particular form with this reason for being exist in the world? And I could go on for a while about that, but if I try to bring it down to what I might call a value statement, I would say that generally speaking, the value is community. And the belief that I have about community is that it is something we need, and I would even go beyond this to cause, I would say it's something that we are made for as human beings. That's one of the ways in which I would see the divine present in the world, is in this aspect of our humanity, the communal aspect of our humanity. I believe that we're better people when we have community. We are kinder, we're more hopeful, we are more nuanced, we are healthier in all sorts of measurable ways. We don't do well in isolation. And again, if we needed sort of more of that measurable data-oriented Western kind of lens on this, we can just look at the long echo of the pandemic in terms of our human experiences and how we're doing. Isolation is hard on us. It's not what we're made for. We need this. We shouldn't be without it just because we're exploring other beliefs. So we may have acquired certain beliefs and even, you know, values in another community setting. And now we're exploring those. We're taking some of those apart. We're leaning into some of that seismic shift of changing a belief. And some of us feel like that means we can't stay in community. I don't believe that that's true. I believe that with some deliberate collective effort, we can together make a community that is a place where exploration can happen without meaning anyone has to explore alone. I think there are practical limits to that, of course. That's why there's lots of different kinds of communities, right? But it's possible to make that kind of a community and to sustain it. Does it take considerable effort? Yes. Does it take the kind of resources that we sometimes shake our heads and go, I'm not sure where we're going to find that? Yes, absolutely it does. Those things are all true. This is challenging. The fact that something's challenging doesn't mean that it's not good. Anyone who's ever tried to do a good thing in a difficult situation knows what that feels like, right? So for me, the table is an enactment. The table is a lived expression of the value of community and the belief that we're better when we have it. And I would expand that by saying it's also given me over and over and over again the opportunity to see how everybody in a community has something valuable to contribute to the making of that community, something positive, needful, and helpful. It's not about a few people making a thing that other people consume. That's not a community. That's a commodity. Lots of religion ends up being commodified and consumed. It's different than community, fundamentally different. In a community, everyone contributes. Everyone brings something of value. And I believe that I feel like I see that and experience that over and over again at the table, for which I'm deeply grateful. All right, I said I could go on for a while. I'm going to just hit the brakes. I'm going to leave it right there for now. And then we'll get into more of the nuances of some of this the next time we're on this topic. And again, there are some other things in the works such that there might be some pauses here. If you do get the blurb, you will have seen the piece that I put there about the Healing Forest, which is coming up in early June, and our visit to that that location. We're still working on some of the details of exactly what we'll do in that experience together and who's going to guide it and so on. But it is on the calendar, that plan for that on June the 4th. We won't be meeting in a building. We'll be outside in this Healing Forest setting here in Winnipeg. I'm really looking forward to that. And then there's some other things in the works in between. I'm not going to say more about that in this context. Watch this space, watch the blurb, watch the website. You know, we'll put this information up there as it unfolds. So I'm going to leave it there for now. We're going to get into more of the nuances next time we're on the topic. And I promise to give that occasion a title that will make it obvious that we're back on this topic when we get there. All right? All right. Thank you. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for listening. Thank you for reflecting back. I really look forward to the comments that I often receive following our virtual gatherings, our online exclusive gatherings, and that come out of the podcasts and all of those different milieu. That puts the interactive or communal part back into this, right? And that's really, as I've just been saying, that's kind of the core. That's the nugget. That's the whatever metaphor you want. I would say often that's the hinge this all turns onto. Okay? Okay. Peace, everybody. I'm going to say goodbye for now, and we'll see you next time.